steering the rudder, so I'm letting you take the oar. If you tell me you can't do it, the boat's going to capsize, and we all might go under, including Fukairi. You don't want that to happen, do you?
Tengo sighed again. Why did he always get himself backed into a corner where he couldn't refuse? Okay, I'll do my best, but I can't promise it's going to work.
That's all I'm asking, Komatsu said. I'll owe you big for this.
I mean, Fukairi seems to have made up her mind not to talk to anyone but you. And there's one more thing. You and I have to set up a new company.
A company?
Company, office, firm, call it anything you like, to handle Fukairi's literary activities. A paper company, of course. Officially, Fukairi will be paid by the company. We'll have Professor Ebisuno be her representative, and you'll be a company employee. We can make up some kind of title for you, it doesn't matter. But the main thing is the company will pay you. I'll be in on it too, but without revealing my name. If people found out that I was involved, that would cause some serious trouble. Anyway, that's how we divide up the profits. All I need is for you to put your seal on a few documents, and I'll take care of the rest. I know a good lawyer.
Tengo thought about what Komatsu was telling him.
Can you please just drop me from your plan? I don't need to be paid. I enjoyed rewriting Air Chrysalis, and I learned a lot from it. I'm glad that Fukairi got the prize, and I'll do my best to prepare her for the press conference. But that's all. I don't want to have anything to do with this convoluted company arrangement. That would be straight-up fraud.
You can't turn your back now, Tengo, Komatsu said.
Straight-up fraud?
Maybe so.
But you must have known that from the start, when we decided to pull the wool over people's eyes with this half-invented author, Fukairi. Am I right? Of course something like this is going to involve money, and that's going to require a sophisticated system to handle it. This is not child's play.
It's too late to start saying you don't want to have anything to do with it, that it's too dangerous, that you don't need money. If you were going to get out of the boat, you should have done it before, while the stream was still gentle. You can't do it now.
We need an official headcount to set up a company, and I can't start bringing in new people now who don't know what's going on.
You have to do it. You're right in the thick of what's happening now.
Tengo racked his brain without producing a single useful thought. I do have one question, though, he said to Komatsu. Judging from what you're saying, Professor Ebisuno intends to give his full approval to the plan. It sounds as if he's already agreed to set up the fake company and act as a representative.
As Fukairi's guardian, the professor understands and approves of the entire situation and has given us the green light. I called him as soon as you told me about your talk with him. He remembered me, of course. I think he didn't say anything about me because he wanted to get your uncensored opinion of me. He said you impressed him as a sharp observer of people. What in the world did you tell him about me?
What does Professor Ebisuno have to gain from participating in this plan? He can't possibly be doing it for the money.
You're right about that. He's not the kind of guy to be influenced by a little spare change.
So why would he let himself get involved in such a risky plan? Does he have something to gain from it?
I don't know any better than you do. He's a hard one to read.
And so are you. That gives us a lot of deep motives to guess about.
Well, anyway, Komatsu said, the professor may look like just another innocent old guy, but in fact he's quite inscrutable.
How much does Fukairi know about the plan?
She doesn't know, and she doesn't need to know, anything about the behind-the-scenes stuff. She trusts Professor Ebisuno, and she likes you. That's why I'm asking you for more help.
Tengo shifted the phone from one hand to the other. He felt a need to trace the progress of the current situation.
By the way, Professor Ebisuno is not a scholar anymore, is he? He left the university, and he's not writing books or anything.
True, he's cut all ties with academia. He was an outstanding scholar, but he doesn't seem to miss the academic world. But then, he never did want much to do with authority or the organization. He was always something of a maverick.
What sort of work is he doing now?
I think he's a stockbroker, Komatsu said. Or if that sounds too old-fashioned, he's an investment consultant. He manages money for people, and while he moves it around for them, he makes his own profit on the side. He stays holed up on the mountaintop, issuing suggestions to buy or sell. His instinct for it is frighteningly good. He also excels at analyzing data and has put together his own system. It was just a hobby for him at first, but it became his main profession. So that's the story. He's pretty famous in those circles. One thing's for sure, he's not hurting for money. I don't see any connection between cultural anthropology and stock trading, Tengo said. In general, there is no connection, but there is for him. And he's a hard one to read.
Exactly.
Tengo pressed his fingertips against his temples. Then, resigning himself to his fate, he said, I'll meet Fukaeri at the usual cafe in Shinjuku at 6 o'clock the day after tomorrow, and we'll prepare for the press conference. That's what you want me to do, right?
That's the plan, Komatsu said.
You know, Tengo, don't think too hard about this stuff for the time being. Just go with the flow. Things like this don't happen all that often in one lifetime. This is the magnificent world of a picaresque novel. Just brace yourself and enjoy the smell of evil. We're shooting the rapids, and when we go over the falls, let's do it together in grand style. Tengo met Fukaeri at the Shinjuku Cafe in the evening, 2 days later. She wore a slim pair of jeans and a thin summer sweater that clearly revealed the outline of her breasts. Her hair hung down long and straight, and her skin had a fresh glow. The male customers kept glancing in her direction. Tengo could feel their gazes. Fukaeri herself, though, seemed totally unaware of them. When this girl was announced as the winner of a literary magazine's new writer's prize, it would almost certainly cause a commotion. Fukaeri had already received word that she had won the prize, but she seemed neither pleased nor excited by it. She didn't care one way or the other. It was a summer-like day, but she ordered hot cocoa and clutched the cup in both hands, savoring every drop. No one had told her about the upcoming press conference, but when Tengo explained, she had no reaction. You do know what a press conference is, don't you?
Press conference, Fukaeri repeated the words.
You sit up on the podium and answer questions from a bunch of newspaper and magazine reporters. They'll take your picture. There might even be TV cameras. The whole country will see reports on the questions and answers. It's very unusual for a 17-year-old girl to win a literary magazine's new writer's award. It'll be big news. They'll make a big deal of the fact that the committee's decision was unanimous. That almost never happens.
Questions and answers, Fukaeri asked.
They ask the questions, you give the answers.
What kind of questions?
All kinds of questions. About the work, about you, about your private life, your hobbies, your plans for the future. It might be a good idea to prepare answers now for those kinds of questions.
Why?
It's safer that way, so you aren't at a loss for answers and don't say anything that might invite misunderstanding. It wouldn't hurt to get ready for it now, kind of like a rehearsal.
Fukaeri drank her cocoa in silence. Then she looked at Tengo with eyes that said, I'm not really interested in doing such a thing, but if you think it's necessary...
Her eyes could be more eloquent, or at least speak more full sentences, than her words, but she could hardly conduct a press conference with her eyes. Tengo took a piece of paper from his briefcase and unfolded it on the table. It contained a list of questions that were likely to come up at the press conference. Tengo had put a lot of time and thought into compiling it the night before.
I'll ask a question, and you answer me as if I'm a newspaper reporter, okay?
Fukaeri nodded.
Have you written lots of stories before?
Lots, Fukaeri replied.
When did you start writing?
A long time ago.
That's fine, Tengo said. Short answers are good. No need to add anything extra, like the fact that Azami did the writing for you. Okay?
Fukaeri nodded.
You shouldn't say anything about that. It's just our little secret, yours and mine.
I won't say anything about that, Fukaeri said.
Did you think you'd win when you submitted your work for the new writer's prize?
She smiled, but said nothing.
So you don't want to answer that?
No.
That's fine. Just keep quiet and smile when you don't want to answer. They're stupid questions, anyway. Fukairi nodded again.
Where did you get the storyline for Air Chrysalis?
From the blind goat.
Good answer. What are your friends at school saying about your winning the prize?
I don't go to school.
Why don't you go to school?
No answer.
Do you plan to keep writing fiction?
Silence again.
Tango drank the last of his coffee and returned the cup to the saucer. From the speakers recessed in the cafe's ceiling, a string performance of soundtrack music from The Sound of Music played at low volume.
Raindrops on roses and whiskers on kittens.
Are my answers bad? Fukairi asked.
Not at all, Tango said. Not at all. They're fine.
Good, Fukairi said.
Tango meant it. Even though she could not speak more than a sentence at a time, and some punctuation marks were missing, her answers were, in a sense, perfect. The best thing was her instant response to every question. Also good was the way she looked directly into the eyes of the questioner without blinking. This proved that her answers were honest, and their shortness was not meant as a put-down. Another bonus was that no one was likely to be able to grasp her precise meaning. That was the main thing that Tengo was hoping for, that she should give an impression of sincerity, even as she mystified her listeners.
Your favorite novel is
The Tale of the Heike. Tengo was astounded. To think that a 13th-century samurai war chronicle should be her favorite novel. What a great answer.
What do you like about The Tale of the Heike?
Everything.
How about another favorite?
Tales of Times Now Past.
But that's even older. Don't you read any new literature?
Fukairi gave it a moment of thought before saying, Sancho the Bailiff.
Wonderful. Ogai Mori must have written that one around 1915. This was what she thought of as new literature.
Do you have any hobbies?
Listening to music.
What kind of music?
I like Bach.
Anything in particular?
BWV 846 to 893.
Tengo mulled that one over.
The Well-Tempered Clavier, books 1 and 2.
Yes.
Why did you answer with the BWV numbers?
They're easier to remember.
The Well-Tempered Clavier was truly heavenly music for mathematicians. It was composed of prelude and fugue pairs in major and minor keys, using all 12 tones of the scale, 24 pieces per book, 48 pieces in all, comprising a perfect cycle.
How about other works? Tengo asked.
BWV 244. Tengo could not immediately recall which work of Bach's had a BWV number of 244. Fukairi began to sing.
Bus und Roy, Bus und Roy, Nier Station den Herzen zwei. Bus und Roy, Bus und Roy, Nier Station den Herzen zwei. Nier Station den Herzen zwei. Bus und Roy, Bus und Roy, Nier Station den Herzen zwei. Bus und Roy, Nier Station den Herzen zwei. Dass die Tropfen meiner Seherren angenehme Spezerei. Treuer Jesu, dir geben.
Tengo was momentarily dumbstruck. Her singing was not exactly on key, but her German pronunciation was amazingly clear and precise.
St. Matthew Passion, Tengo said. You know it by heart.
No, I don't, the girl said. Tengo wanted to say something, but the words would not come to him. All he could do was look down at his notes and move on to the next question.
Do you have a boyfriend?
Fukairi shook her head.
Why not?
I don't want to get pregnant.
It's possible to have a boyfriend without getting pregnant.
Fukairi said nothing, but instead blinked several times.
Why don't you want to get pregnant?
Fukairi kept her mouth clamped shut. Tengo felt sorry for having asked such a stupid question.
Okay, let's stop, Tengo said, returning the list to his briefcase. We don't really know what they're going to ask, and you'll be fine answering them any way you like. You can do it.
That's good, Fukaeri said, with apparent relief. I'm sure you think it's a waste of time to prepare these answers.
Fukaeri gave a little shrug.
I agree with you. I'm not doing this because I want to. Mr. Komatsu asked me to do it.
Fukaeri nodded.
But, Tengo said, please don't tell anyone that I rewrote Air Chrysalis. You understand that, don't you?
Fukaeri nodded twice.
I wrote it by myself.
In any case, Air Chrysalis is your work alone, and no one else's. That has been clear from the outset.
I wrote it by myself, Fukaeri said again.
Did you read my rewritten Air Chrysalis?
Azami read it to me.
How did you like it?
You're a good writer.
Which means you liked it, I suppose?
It's like I wrote it, Fukaeri said.
Tengo looked at her. She picked up her cocoa cup and took a sip. He had to struggle not to look at the lovely swell of her chest. I'm glad to hear that, he said. I really enjoyed rewriting Air Chrysalis. Of course, it was very hard work trying not to destroy what you'd done with it, so it's very important to me to know whether you liked the finished product or not.
Fukaeri nodded silently.
Then, as if trying to ascertain something, she brought her hand up to her small, well-formed earlobe. The waitress approached and refilled their water glasses. Tengo took a swallow to moisten his throat. Then, screwing up his courage, he gave voice to a thought that he had been toying with for a while. I have my own request to make of you now, if you don't mind.
What's that?
I'd like you to go to the press conference in the same clothes you're wearing today.
Fukaeri gave him a puzzled look.
Then she looked down to check each article of clothing she had on, as if she had been unaware until this moment of what she was wearing.
You want me to go wearing this? She asked.
Right. I'd like you to go to the press conference wearing exactly what you're wearing now.
Why?
It looks good on you. It shows off the shape of your chest beautifully. This is strictly my own hunch, but I suspect the reporters won't be able to stop themselves from looking down there, and they'll forget to ask you tough questions. Of course, if you don't like the idea, that's fine. I'm not insisting.
Fukaeri said, Azami picks all my clothes.
Not you.
I don't care what I wear.
So Azami picked your outfit today?
Azami picked it.
Even so, it looks great on you.
So this outfit makes my chest look good? She asked, without a question mark.
Most definitely. It's a real attention-getter.
This sweater and bra are a good match.
Fukaeri looked straight into his eyes. Tengo felt himself blushing.
I can't tell what kind of matching is involved, but the, effect is excellent.
Fukaeri was still staring into Tengo's eyes.
Gravely, she asked, You can't stop yourself from looking down there.
It's true, I must confess, Tengo said.
Fukaeri pulled on the collar of her sweater and all but stuck her nose inside as she looked down, apparently to check out what kind of bra she had on today. Then she focused her eyes on Tengo's bright red face for a moment, as if looking at some kind of curiosity.
I will do as you say, she said a moment later.
Thank you, Tengo said, bringing their session to an end. Tengo walked Fukaeri to Shinjuku Station. Many people on the street had their jackets off. A few women wore sleeveless tops. The bustle of people combined with the traffic created the liberated sound unique to the city. A fresh, early summer breeze swept down the street. Tengo was mystified. Where could such a wonderful-smelling wind come from to reach the crowded streets of Shinjuku?
"Are you going back to your house in the country?" Tengo asked Fukaeri. The trains were jammed. It would take her forever to get home.
Fukaeri shook her head.
I have a room in Shinanumachi, just a few minutes away from here.
You stay there when it gets too late to go home.
Futamatao is too far away.
As before, Fukaeri held Tengo's left hand while they were walking to the station. She did it the way a little girl holds a grown-up's hand, but still it made Tengo's heart pound to have his hand held by such a beautiful girl. When they reached the station, she let go of his hand and bought a ticket to Shinanomachi from the machine.
Don't worry about the press conference, Fukaeri said.
I'm not worried.
Even if you don't worry, I can do it okay.
I know that, Tengo said.
I'm not the least bit worried. I'm sure it will be okay. Without speaking, Fukaeri disappeared through the ticket gate into the crowd. After leaving Fukaeri, Tengo went to a little bar near the Kinokuniya bookstore and ordered a gin and tonic. This was a bar he would go to now and then. He liked the old-fashioned decor and the fact that they had no music playing. He sat alone at the bar and stared at his left hand for a while, thinking nothing in particular. This was the hand that Fukaeri had been holding. It still retained her touch. He thought about her chest, its beautiful curves. The shape was so perfect, it had almost no sexual meaning. As he thought about these things, Tengo found himself wanting to talk with his older girlfriend on the telephone. To talk about anything at all. Her complaints about child raising, the approval rating of the Nakasone government, it didn't matter. He just wanted to hear her voice. If possible, he wanted to meet her somewhere right away and have sex with her. But calling her at home was out of the question. Her husband might answer. One of her children might answer. He never did the phoning. That was one of their rules they had established. Tengo ordered another gin and tonic, and while he waited for it, he imagined himself in a little boat shooting the rapids. On the phone, Komatsu had said, "When we go over the falls, let's do it together in grand style." But could Tengo take him at his word? Wouldn't Komatsu leap onto a handy boulder just before they reached the falls? "Sorry, Tengo," he would say, "but I just remembered some business I have to take care of. I'll leave the rest of this to you." And the only one to go over the falls in style would be Tengo himself. It was not inconceivable. Indeed, it was all too conceivable. He went home, went to bed, and dreamed. He hadn't had such a vivid dream in a very long time. He was a tiny piece in a gigantic puzzle. But instead of having one fixed shape, his shape kept changing, and so, of course, he couldn't fit anywhere. As he tried to sort out where he belonged, he was also given a set amount of time to gather the scattered pages of the timpani section of a score. A strong wind swept the pages in all directions. He went around picking up one page at a time. He had to check the page numbers and arrange them in order, as his body changed shape like an amoeba. The situation was out of control. Eventually, Fukaeri came along and grabbed his left hand. Tengo's shape stopped changing. The wind suddenly died and stopped scattering the pages of the score. What a relief, Tengo thought. But in that instant, his time began to run out. "This is the end," Fukaeri informed him in a whisper. One sentence, as always. Time stopped, and the world ended. The earth ground slowly to a halt, and all sound and light vanished. When he woke up the next day, the world was still there, and things were already moving forward, like the great karmic wheel of Indian mythology that kills every living thing in its path.
Chapter 17. Aomame. Whether we are happy or unhappy. Aomame stepped out onto her balcony again the next night to find that there were still two moons in the sky. The big one was the normal moon. It wore a mysterious white coating, as if it had just burrowed its way there through a mountain of ash. But aside from that, it was the same old moon she was used to seeing, the moon that Neil Armstrong marked with the first small step but giant leap in that hot summer of 1969. Hanging next to it was a small, green, lopsided moon, nestled shyly by the big moon like an inferior child. "There must be something wrong with my mind," Aomame thought. "There has always been only one moon, and there should only be one now. If the number of moons had suddenly increased to two, it should have caused some actual changes to life on Earth. The tides, say, should have been seriously altered, and everyone would be talking about it. I couldn't possibly have failed to notice it until now. This is different from just happening to miss some articles in the paper. Or is it really so different? Can I declare that with 100% certainty?" Mama scowled for a time. Strange things keep happening around me these days. The world is moving ahead on its own without my being aware of it, as if we're playing a game in which everybody else can move only when I have my eyes closed. Then it might not be so strange for there to be two moons hanging in the sky side by side. Perhaps, at some point when my mind was sleeping, the little one happened along from somewhere in space and decided to settle into the Earth's gravitational field, looking like a distant cousin of the moon. Police officers were issued new uniforms and new pistols. The police and a radical group staged a wild gun battle in the mountains of Yamanashi. These things occurred without my being aware of them. There was also a news report that the U.S. and the USSR jointly constructed a moon base. Could there be some connection between that and the increase in the number of moons? Almame probed her memory to see if there had been an article about the new moon in the compact edition of the newspaper she read in the library, but could think of nothing. She wished that she could ask someone about these things, but she had no idea whom to ask nor how to go about it. Would it be all right for her just to say, "Hey, I think there are two moons in the sky. Do you mind having a look for me?" No, it would be a stupid question under any circumstances. If the number of moons had in fact increased to two, it would be strange for her not to know that. If there were still only one moon, people would think she had gone crazy. She lowered herself into the aluminum chair, resting her feet on the balcony railing. She thought of 10 different ways of asking the question, and some she even tried out loud, but they all sounded as stupid as the first. Oh, what the hell? The whole situation defies common sense. There's no way to come up with a sensible question about it, obviously. She decided to shelve the question of the second moon for the time being. I'll just wait and see what happens. It's not causing me any practical problems for now. And maybe at some point I'll notice that it disappeared when I wasn't looking. She went to the sports club in Hiro the following afternoon, taught two martial arts classes, and had one private lesson. Stopping by the front desk, she was surprised to find a message for her from the dowager in Azabu, asking her to call when she was free. Tamaru answered the phone as always. He explained that the dowager wondered if Almama could come to the house the following day if possible. She wanted the usual program, to be followed by a light supper. Almama said she could come after 4 and that she would be delighted to join the dowager for supper. Tamaru confirmed the appointment, but before he could hang up, Almama asked him if he had seen the moon lately. "The moon?" Tamaru asked. "You mean the moon, up in the sky?" "Yes, the moon. I can't say I recall consciously looking at it recently. Is something going on with the moon?" "Nothing special," Almama said. "All right. See you after 4 tomorrow." Tamaru hesitated a moment before hanging up. There were two moons again that night, both 2 days past full. Almama had a glass of brandy in one hand as she stared at the pair of moons, big and small, as if it an unsolvable puzzle. The more she looked, the more enigmatic the combination felt to her. If only she could ask the moon directly. "How did you suddenly come by this little green companion of yours?" But the moon would not favor her with a reply. The moon had been observing the Earth close up longer than anyone. It must have witnessed all of the phenomena occurring, and all of the acts carried out on this Earth. But the moon remained silent. It told no stories. All it did was embrace the heavy past with cool, measured detachment. On the moon, there was neither air nor wind. Its vacuum was perfect for preserving memories unscathed. No one could unlock the heart of the moon. Almama raised her glass to the moon and asked, "Have you gone to bed with someone in your arms lately?" The moon did not answer. "Do you have any friends?" she asked. The moon did not answer. Don't you get tired of always playing it cool? The moon did not answer. Tamaru met her at the front door as always. I saw the moon last night, he said immediately. Oh, really? Amama said. Thanks to you, I started wondering about it. I hadn't stopped and looked at the moon in quite a while. Very nice. Very calming. Were you with a lover? Exactly, Tamaru said, tapping the side of his nose. Is something up with the moon? Not at all, Amama said, then added cautiously, It's just that... I don't know. I've been concerned about the moon lately. For no reason at all? Nothing in particular, Amama said. Tamaru nodded in silence. He seemed to be drawing his own conclusions. This man did not trust things that lacked reasons. Instead of pursuing the matter, however, he led Amama to the sunroom. The dowager was there, dressed in a jersey top and bottom for exercise, seated in her reading chair, and listening to John Dowland's instrumental piece Lacrimae while reading a book. This was one of her favorite pieces of music. Amama had heard it many times and knew the melody. Sorry for the short notice, the dowager said. This time slot just happened to open up yesterday. You don't have to apologize to me, Amama said. Tamaru carried in a tray, holding a pot of herbal tea, and proceeded to fill two elegant cups. He closed the door on his way out, leaving the two women alone. They drank their tea in silence, listening to Dowland and looking at the blaze of azalea blossoms in the garden. Whenever she came here, Amama felt she was in another world. The air was heavy, and time had its own special way of flowing. The dowager said, Often when I listen to this music, I'm struck by mysterious emotions with regard to time. She seemed almost to have read Amama's mind. To think that people 400 years ago were listening to the same music we're hearing now. Doesn't it make you feel strange? It does, Amama said. But come to think of it, those people 400 years ago were looking at the same moon we see. The dowager looked at Amama with a hint of surprise. Then she nodded. You're quite right about that. Looking at it that way, I guess there's nothing mysterious about people listening to the same music 400 years apart. Perhaps I should have said almost the same moon, Amama said, looking at the dowager. Her remarks seemed to have made no impression on the older woman. The performance on this CD uses period instruments, the dowager said, exactly as it was written at the time, so the music sounds pretty much as it did back then. It's like the moon. Amama said, even if things were the same, people's perception of them might have been very different back then. The darkness of night was probably deeper then, so the moon must have been that much bigger and brighter. And of course people didn't have records or tapes or CDs. They couldn't hear proper performances of music any time they liked. It was always something special. I'm sure you're right, the dowager said. Things are so convenient for us these days. Our perceptions are probably that much duller. Even if it's the same moon hanging in the sky, we may be looking at something quite different. 400 years ago, we might have had richer spirits that were closer to nature. It was a cruel world, though. More than half of all children died before they could reach maturity, thanks to chronic epidemics and malnutrition. People dropped like flies from polio and tuberculosis and smallpox and measles. There probably weren't very many people who lived past 40. Women bore so many children, they became toothless old hags by the time they were in their 30s. People often had to resort to violence to survive. Tiny children were forced to do such heavy labor that their bones became deformed, and little girls were forced to become prostitutes on a daily basis. Little boys, too, I suspect. Most people led minimal lives in worlds that had nothing to do with richness of perception or spirit. City streets were full of cripples and beggars and criminals. Only a small fraction of the population could gaze at the moon with deep feeling, or enjoy a Shakespeare play, or listen to the beautiful music of Dowland. The Dowager smiled. What an interesting person you are. Ah, Mama said, I'm a very ordinary human being. I just happen to like reading books, especially history books. I like history books, too. They teach us that we're basically the same, whether now or in the old days. There may be a few differences in clothing and lifestyle, but there's not that much difference in what we think and do. Human beings are ultimately nothing but carriers, passageways for genes. They ride us into the ground like racehorses from generation to generation. Genes don't think about what constitutes good or evil. They don't care whether we are happy or unhappy. We're just a means to an end for them. The only thing they think about is what is most efficient for them. In spite of that, we can't help but think about what is good and what is evil. Is that what you're saying? The Dowager nodded. Exactly. People have to think about those things. But genes are what control the basis for how we live. Naturally, a contradiction arises, she said with a smile. Their conversation about history ended there. They drank the rest of their herbal tea and proceeded with martial arts training. That day, they shared a simple dinner in the Dowager's house. A simple meal is all I can offer you, if that's all right, the Dowager said. That's fine with me, Ah Mama said. Tamaru rolled their meal in on a wagon. A professional chef had doubtless prepared the food, but it was Tamaru's job to serve it. He plucked the bottle of white wine from its ice bucket and poured with practiced movements. The Dowager and Ah Mama both tasted the wine. It had a lovely bouquet and was perfectly chilled. The dinner consisted of boiled white asparagus, salad niçoise, a crab meat omelet, and rolls and butter, nothing more. All the ingredients were fresh and delicious, and the portions were moderate. The Dowager always ate small amounts of food. She used her knife and fork elegantly, bringing one tiny bite after another to her mouth, like a small bird. Tamaru stayed in the farthest corner of the room throughout the meal. Ah Mama was always amazed how such a powerfully built man could obscure his own presence for such a long time. The two women spoke only in brief snatches during the meal, concentrating instead on what they ate. Music played at low volume, a Haydn cello concerto. This was another of the Dowager's favorites. After the dishes were taken away, a coffee pot arrived. Tamaru poured, and as he backed away, the Dowager turned to him with the finger raised. Thank you, Tamaru. That will be all. Tamaru nodded respectfully and left the room, his footsteps silent as always. The door closed quietly behind him. While the two women drank their coffee, the music ended and a new silence came to the room. You and I trust each other, wouldn't you say? The Dowager said, looking straight at Ah Mama. Ah Mama agreed, succinctly, but without reservation. We share some important secrets, the Dowager said. We have put our fate in each other's hands. Ah Mama nodded silently. This was the room in which Ah Mama first confessed her secret to the Dowager. Ah Mama remembered the day clearly. She had known that someday she would have to share the burden she carried in her heart with someone. She could keep it locked up inside herself only so long, and already she was reaching her limit. And so, when the Dowager said something to draw her out, Ah Mama had flung open the door. She told the Dowager how her best friend had lost her mental balance after 2 years of physical violence from her husband, and, unable to flee from him, in agony she had committed suicide. Al-Mamet allowed nearly a year to pass before concocting an excuse to visit the man's house. There, following an elaborate plan of her own devising, she killed him with a single needle thrust to the back of the neck. It caused no bleeding and left no visible wound. His death was treated simply as the result of illness. No one had any suspicions. Al-Mamet felt that she had done nothing wrong, she told the dowager, either then or now. Nor did she feel any pangs of conscience, though this fact did nothing to lessen the burden of having purposely taken the life of a human being. The dowager had listened attentively to Al-Mamet's long confession, offering no comment even when Al-Mamet occasionally faltered in her detailed account. When Al-Mamet finished her story, the dowager asked for clarification on a few particulars. Then she reached over and firmly grasped Al-Mamet's hand for a very long time. "What you did was right," she said, speaking slowly and with conviction. "If he had lived, he eventually would have done the same kind of thing to other women. Men like that always find victims. They're made to do it over and over. You severed the evil at the root. Rest assured, it was not mere personal vengeance." Al-Mamet buried her face in her hands and cried. She was crying for Tamaki. The dowager found a handkerchief and wiped her tears. "This is a strange coincidence," the dowager said in a low but resolute voice. "But I also once made a man vanish for almost exactly the same reason." Al-Mamet raised her head and looked at the dowager. She did not know what to say. What could she be talking about? The dowager continued, "I did not do it directly myself, of course. I had neither the physical strength nor your special training. But I did make him vanish through the means that I had at my disposal, leaving behind no concrete evidence. Even if I were to turn myself in and confess, it would be impossible to prove, just as it would be for you. I suppose, if there is to be some judgment after death, a god will be the one to judge me. But that doesn't frighten me in the least. I did nothing wrong. I reserve the right to declare the justice of my case in anyone's presence." The dowager sighed with apparent relief before continuing, "So then, you and I now have our hands on each other's deepest secrets, don't we?" Al-Mamet still could not fully grasp what the dowager was telling her. She made a man vanish? Caught between deep doubt and intense shock, Al-Mamet's face began to lose its normal shape. To calm her down, the dowager began to explain what had happened in a tranquil tone of voice. Circumstances similar to those of Tamaki Otsuka had led her daughter to end her own life, the dowager said. Her daughter had married the wrong man. The dowager had known from the beginning that the marriage would not go well. She could clearly see that the man had a twisted personality. He had already been involved in several bad situations, their cause almost certainly deeply rooted. But no one could stop the daughter from marrying him. As the dowager had expected, there were repeated instances of domestic violence. The daughter gradually lost whatever self-respect and self-confidence she had, and sank into a deep depression. Robbed of the strength to stand on her own, she felt increasingly like an ant trapped in a bowl of sand. Finally, she washed down a large number of sleeping pills with whiskey. The autopsy revealed many signs of violence on her body. Bruises from punching and severe battering, broken bones, and numerous burn scars from cigarettes pressed against the flesh. Both wrists showed signs of having been tightly bound. The man apparently enjoyed using a rope. Her nipples were deformed. The husband was called in and questioned by the police. He was willing to admit to some use of violence, but he maintained that it had been part of their sexual practice, under mutual consent, to satisfy his wife's preferences. As in Tamaki's case, the police were unable to find the husband legally responsible. The wife had never filed a complaint, and now she was dead. The husband was a man of some social standing, and he had hired a capable criminal lawyer. And finally, there was no room for doubt that the death had been a suicide. "Did you kill the man?" Aomame ventured to ask. "No, I didn't kill him. Not that man," the dowager said. Unclear where this was heading, Aomame simply stared at her in silence. The dowager said, "My daughter's former husband, that contemptible man, is still alive in this world. He wakes up in bed every morning and walks down the street on his own 2 feet. Mere killing is not what I had planned for him." She paused for a moment to allow Aomame to absorb her words fully. "I have socially destroyed my former son-in-law, leaving nothing behind. It just so happens that I possess that kind of power. The man is a weakling. He has a degree of intelligence, he speaks well, and has gained some social recognition, but he is basically weak and despicable. Men who wield great violence at home against their wives and children are invariably people of weak character. They prey upon those who are weaker than themselves precisely because of their own weakness. Destroying him was easy. Once men like that are destroyed, they can never recover. My daughter died a long time ago, but I have kept watch over him to this day. If he ever shows signs of recovery, I will not allow it to happen. He goes on living, but he might as well be a corpse. He won't kill himself. He doesn't have the courage to do that. And I won't do him the favor of killing him either. My method is to go on tormenting him mercilessly, without let-up, but without killing him, as though skinning him alive. The man I made vanish was another person. A practical reason made it necessary for me to have him move to another place." The dowager went on to explain this to Aomame. The year after her daughter killed herself, the dowager set up a private safe house for women who were suffering from the same kind of domestic violence. She owned a small, two-story apartment building on a plot of land adjoining her Willow House property in Azabu, and had kept it unoccupied, intending to demolish it before long. Instead, she decided to renovate the building and use it as a safe house for women who had nowhere else to go. She also opened a downtown consultation office through which women suffering from domestic violence could seek advice, primarily from lawyers in the metropolitan area. It was staffed by volunteers who took turns doing interviews and giving telephone counseling. The office kept in touch with the dowager at home. Women who needed an emergency shelter would be sent to the safe house, often with children in tow, some of whom were teenage girls who had been sexually abused by their fathers. They would stay there until more permanent arrangements could be made for them. They would be provided with basic necessities, food, clothing, and they would help each other in a kind of communal living arrangement. The dowager personally took care of all their expenses. The lawyers and counselors made regular visits to the safe house to check on the women's progress and discuss plans for their futures. The dowager would also drop in when she had time, listening to each woman's story and offering her advice. Sometimes she would find them jobs or more permanent places to live. When troubles arose requiring intervention of a physical nature, Tamaru would head over to the safe house and handle them. Say, for example, when a husband would learn of his wife's whereabouts and forcibly try to take her back. No one could deal with such problems as quickly and expeditiously as Tamaru. There are those cases, however, that neither Tamaru nor I can fully deal with, and for which we can find no practical remedy through the law, the dowager said. Almame noticed that, as the dowager spoke, her face took on a certain bronze glow, and her usual mild-mannered elegance faded until it had disappeared entirely. What took its place was a certain something that transcended mere anger or disgust. It was probably that small, hard, nameless core that lies in the deepest part of the mind. In spite of the facial change, however, her voice remained as cool and dispassionate as ever. Of course, a person's existence, or non-existence, cannot be decided on the basis of mere practical considerations. For example, if he is no longer there, it will eliminate the difficulties of divorce, say, or hasten the payment of life insurance. We take such action only as a last resort, after examining all factors closely and fairly, and arriving at the conclusion that the man deserves no mercy. These parasitical men, who can only live by sucking the blood of the weak. These incurable men with their twisted minds. They have no interest in rehabilitating themselves, and we can find no value in having them continue to live in this world. The dowager closed her mouth and momentarily glared at Almame with eyes that could pierce a rock wall. Then she went on in her usual calm tone. All we can do with such men is make them vanish one way or another, but always taking care not to attract people's attention. Is such a thing possible? There are many ways for people to vanish, the dowager said, pausing to let her words sink in. Then she continued. I can arrange for people to vanish in certain ways. I have that kind of power at my disposal. Almame struggled to understand, but the dowager's words were too obscure. The dowager said, You and I have both lost people who were important to us. We lost them in outrageous ways, and we are both deeply scarred from the experience. Such wounds to the heart will probably never heal. But we cannot simply sit and stare at our wounds forever. We must stand up and move on to the next action, not for the sake of our own individual vengeance, but for the sake of a more far-reaching form of justice. Will you help me in my work? I need a capable collaborator in whom I can put my trust, someone with whom I can share my secrets and my mission. Will you be that person? Are you willing to join me? Almame took some time to fully comprehend what the dowager had said to her. It was an incredible confession and an equally incredible proposal. Almame needed even more time to decide how she felt about the proposal. As she sorted this out for herself, the dowager maintained a perfect silence, sitting motionless in her chair, staring hard at Almame. She was in no hurry. She seemed prepared to wait as long as it took. Without a doubt, this woman has been enveloped by a form of madness, thought Almame. But she herself is not mad or psychologically ill. No, her mind is rock steady, unshakably cool. That fact is backed up by positive proof. Rather than madness, it's something that resembles madness. A correct prejudice, perhaps. What she wants now is for me to share her madness, or prejudice, or whatever it is, with the same cool-headedness that she has. She believes that I am qualified to do that. How long had she been thinking? She seemed to have lost her grasp of time at some point, while she was deeply absorbed in her own thoughts. Only her heart continued to tick off the time in its hard, fixed rhythm. Aomame visited several little rooms she possessed inside her, tracing time backward, the way a fish swims upstream. She found there familiar sights and long-forgotten smells, gentle nostalgia, and severe pain. Suddenly, from some unknown source, a narrow beam of light pierced Aomame's body. She felt as though, mysteriously, she had become transparent. When she held her hand up in the beam, she could see through it. Suddenly, there was no longer any weight to her body. At this moment, Aomame thought, "Even if I give myself over to the madness or prejudice here and now, even if doing so destroys me, even if this world vanishes in its entirety, what do I have to lose?" "I see," Aomame said to the dowager. She paused, biting her lip. And then she said, "I would like to help in any way I can." The dowager reached out and grasped Aomame's hands. From that moment onward, Aomame and the dowager shared their secrets, shared their mission, and shared that something that resembled madness. It may well have been sheer madness itself, though Aomame was unable to locate the dividing line. The men that she and the dowager together dispatched to a faraway world were ones for whom there were no grounds, from any point of view, for granting them mercy. "Not much time has gone by since you moved that man in the Shibuya Hotel to another world," the dowager said softly. The way she talked about moving him to another world, she could as well have been talking about a piece of furniture. "In another 4 days, it will be exactly 2 months." "Still less than 2 months, is it?" the dowager went on. "I really shouldn't be asking you to do another job so soon. I would prefer to put at least 6 months between them. If we space them too closely, it will increase your psychological burden. This is not, how should I put it, an ordinary task. In addition to which, someone might start suspecting that the number of heart attack deaths among men connected with my safe house was a bit too high." Aomame smiled slightly and said, "Yes, there are so many distrustful people around." The dowager also smiled. She said, "As you know, I am a very, very careful person. I don't believe in coincidence or forecasts or good luck. I search for the least drastic possibilities in dealing with these men, and only when it becomes clear that no such possibilities exist do I choose the ultimate solution. And when, as a last resort, I take such a step, I eliminate all conceivable risks. I examine all the elements with painstaking attention to detail, make unstinting preparations, and only after I am convinced that it will work do I come to you. Which is why, so far, we have not had a single problem." "We haven't, have we?" "No, you're absolutely right," Aomame said, and she meant it. She would prepare her equipment, make her way to the designated place, and find the situation arranged exactly as planned. She would plunge her needle, once, into the one precise spot on the back of the man's neck. Finally, after making sure that the man had moved to another place, she would leave. Up to now, everything had worked smoothly and systematically. "About this next case, though," the dowager continued, "sorry to say, I am probably going to have to ask you to do something far more challenging. Our timetable has not fully matured yet, and there are many uncertainties.